Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on the program, the Wind River Reservation Tribes have collaborated to pass a law combating violence against women.
And our community no longer has to be taboo. It's okay to speak out. It's okay to report these things. It's okay to be a victim.
A geyser that's normally inactive in Yellowstone National Park has erupted four times in the last 2 months. Does this mean doomsday is near, or is it normal?
What's normal for Yellowstone is for geysers to go off, mud pots to bubble up like you hear the blub blub.
A story about a 50-million-year-old mammal found in a southwest Wyoming quarry and why it's so valuable.
Plus, Congress has crafted a water bill that could have lots of support in Wyoming. These stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Wyoming U.S. Senator John Barrasso helped craft a sweeping bipartisan bill that could go a long way to deal with Wyoming water issues. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story on how proponents are hopeful it may be one of the few pieces of legislation to actually pass this election year.
Most big legislative efforts have now ground to a halt in Washington ahead of November's elections. But Senator Barrasso helped craft a new compromise bill that's aimed at revitalizing the nation's ailing water infrastructure, which he says is vital for the Mountain West.
Water is critical, as we say in the West. Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over.
The legislation attempts to boost local water storage capacity out west, while also assisting rural communities at risk of flooding, and it helps communities clean their water supply and improve their irrigation systems. Barrasso says it's a win for the state.
And we need to make sure we have the capacity and the storage in Wyoming. So, yeah, we have a lot of bipartisan agreement on getting the decisions out of Washington, back closer to home, so people on the ground can make decisions rather than somebody sitting in an office in Washington, D.C.
As chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee, Barrasso was able to include a lot of input in the new bill after hearing testimony from Wyoming residents.
Including a county commissioner from Warland, Wyoming, Washakie County, to talk about the needs there that they have with ice jams and the damage that that can do. We have people that can talk about what's happening with a silt buildup. And you have that buildup in a reservoir, then the reservoir has less capacity for the water that we need during dry times.
The bill also seeks to update America's ports, which ship out a lot of Wyoming coal and natural gas. But striking a deal that makes urban lawmakers and rural lawmakers happy isn't easy, according to Barrasso.
This is something that takes a lot of commitment to get it done in a bipartisan way. You have rural communities which have huge water needs. You have coastal communities which have needs. In terms of the overall economy of the United States, the rivers and the ports play a tremendous role in moving product around the country.
Delaware Senator Tom Carper is the top Democrat on the committee. He says he, Barrasso, and others were able to go old school on the effort. Carper recounts him asking Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi how he was able to forge compromises when he sat across from the more liberal Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy on the Health and Education Committee.
How do you work together to get so much done? And Mike Enzi said, Ted and I agree on about 8% of stuff we disagree on. 20% we focus on the 80% that we agree on. And on this legislation, we're focusing on the 80%.
Carper says the federal government actually plays a huge role in the nation's water infrastructure, which is why the legislation is vital.
99% of the freight that moves in and out of our ports in America, 99% comes through waterways that are maintained by the Army Corps of Engineers. Everybody has a dog in this fight. Everybody.
Other members of the committee also say they see no reason why the bill shouldn't sail to President Trump's desk this year, including Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin.
Oh, I think it's excellent. Oh, I think we have an excellent chance. It's got strong bipartisan support. It's in the range that is likely to get through. I would get 60 votes easily. I think it's a good chance.
Still, Cardin and other Democrats are disappointed the bill isn't included in Trump's initial call for a more than $1 trillion infrastructure bill that's now been shelved.
I think the scope might not be as large as we would like it to be because we don't have more revenues, so we have to keep it modest. But there's a lot of things in addition to money that's in this bill.
Still, Senator Barrasso says doing such a sweeping, expensive bill was never the game plan for him and other members of the Republican leadership team at the Capitol.
Well, we've talked about infrastructure being done piece by piece rather than one huge bill, and this is the first part of that. This is the water infrastructure bill. There'll also be work we're working that we're doing in terms of bridges, highways, roads. So it's all part of the needs of the country. But right now, we're very successfully moving ahead in a bipartisan way on water infrastructure, which is really important for Wyoming.
There's still no timeline for when Barrasso's water infrastructure bill may hit the Senate floor. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Abnormal activity in Yellowstone National Park has some people thinking the end of the world is near. In the past 2 months, Steamboat Geyser has erupted 4 times. This is highly unusual for the geyser, which, unlike Old Faithful, can go years between eruptions. Some believe this means the supervolcano that sits beneath Yellowstone will erupt next. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports on whether doomsday is really upon us.
Ready?
That's the sound of a stimulated caldera explosion. It's essentially a science project being conducted at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. Education specialist George Miller and his colleagues are using flour, a balloon, and some air to show how the supervolcano erupted. Miller says this is how the Yellowstone Plateau was created.
When the balloon is inflating, that simulates the expansion of the top of the plume, the hotspot, the Yellowstone hotspot. And then when it goes off, it is the eruption.
Steamboat Geyser erupts infrequently, and before this recent surge, it last erupted 4 years ago. And because of this, some are predicting doomsday is near.
So do these eruptions of Steamboat, the last 4 eruptions, mean that the supervolcano is next?
No, we do not believe so.
That's Morgan Worthen with Yellowstone National Park. We're standing in front of the Steamboat Geyser. Currently, steam is coming out of the vent, but hopeful visitors linger over 10 minutes to see if they can catch an eruption. Worthen says Yellowstone has the largest concentration of thermal activity in the world, with over 10,000 hydrothermal features.
What's normal for Yellowstone is for geysers to go off, mud pots to bubble up, like you hear the blub blub. It's active seismically, so earthquakes are quite common, small earthquakes.
Yellowstone is unique because of its thermal activity. And to understand why the 4 consecutive eruptions of Steamboat Geyser does not mean that the volcano will erupt anytime soon, we need to go back in time.
About 2 million years ago, we've had 3 giant volcanic eruptions. People call them super eruptions.
That's Bob Smith. He's been studying Yellowstone geology and geophysics for 61 years. And the 3rd and last eruption, 631,000 years ago, created the caldera or the plateau. Smith says hot magma sits very deep below it.
The magma from Yellowstone comes up from the Earth depth of about 1,800 miles, rises vertically.
A small amount of the magma passed through the cold part of the North American continent, which formed 2 magma reservoirs. But these chambers only contain 7% of molten rock. Smith says water that comes from rain, snow, and rivers is heated up by the heat source only a few miles down.
When you heat them up, the Earth has pockets of highly fractured volumes that we call hydrothermal reservoirs. And it's these hydrothermal reservoirs that fuel Yellowstone's geysers, Yellowstone's hot springs.
So basically, compare a geyser eruption to a steam kettle. The water gets heated up, and the higher temperature and pressure surpasses the available space and spews hot water and steam out of the spout. Mike Poland is the scientist in charge of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. He says scientists aren't exactly sure what conditions cause a geyser to erupt more often than others. But Old Faithful seems to have a more stable plumbing system.
Everything's sort of steady state, then you might expect some behavior that's a bit more predictable or a bit more regular.
But one thing is for sure. Just because Steamboat has erupted 4 times in the last 2 months does not mean the supervolcano is next.
These erratic geyser eruptions are much more a product of what's happening in the upper few hundred meters, say, of the surface, changes in water flux.
Not thousands of kilometers down where the magma sits. Poland says people are excited about Steamboat Geyser erupting more often because of the element of surprise.
Even sitting here now, I'm sort of wondering, you know, is it going to go? Is it going to go? Come on.
I know.
And I think people have this sense of, you, even if it's been years, you never know. You might be standing right here and experience the eruption of the tallest geyser in the world.
Something most people would like to see without all of Yellowstone blowing up with it. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Kamila Kudelska from the Center of the West in Cody.
Coming up, a discussion about childcare. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. When it comes to ticks, people tend to think of the East Coast and Lyme disease. But we have ticks, too, well into the Rocky Mountains. Ray Ellen Bichelle went out with a couple of tick scientists in Rocky Mountain National Park to check for bugs and the rare but nasty viruses they could be carrying.
Dan Zalkeld estimates he's collected 6,000 or 7,000 ticks over his career, and he actually likes it. He's a disease ecologist at Colorado State University, and he came today dressed in a short-sleeved t-shirt and a baseball hat.
I've turned into tick cowboy. Nothing's going to go wrong with me.
His partner in tick hunting today is Alyssa Beck. She took a different tack.
So she's bought a Tyvek suit because she's nervous.
I'm not nervous.
Beck says she's collected far too many ticks by accident, so she's zipping into a full-body plastic suit, the kind you'd get at Home Depot for painting a house. It even has a hood.
How ridiculous do I look already?
Like the marshmallow in Ghostbusters.
They pull out white flannel flags. That's what they'll use to entice the ticks out of the grass and bushes.
Okay, ready? Let's go this way.
They aren't so interested in the ticks themselves as they are in what might be hiding inside the bugs, specifically two viruses. One of them is called Colorado tick fever.
And apparently it's, like, horrendous.
The virus gives people fevers, chills, aches, and fatigue. There's no treatment.
But then it's, I think, self-curing, so you don't have chronic impacts later on.
But they're also looking for something much worse. It's called Powassan virus, and it's a nasty one currently hitting the Northeast and Midwest. Powassan can give people anything from a fever and headache to brain swelling, confusion, seizures, and even memory loss.
It can be fatal.
So is Powassan heading here? Turns out it's been here already.
It was found in 1960, but few people have looked ever since.
But now, Zalkeld and Beck are on it. They're hiking through Ponderosa Pine Forest, dragging those white flannel flags across the ground.
I like to undulate as we go.
Like a frolicking deer.
Yeah, exactly.
We're about 8,000 feet up, with a backdrop of stunning mountains.
Nothing yet.
Nope.
Oh, no, that's just a regular bug.
About 15 minutes in, no ticks. And then finally, there it was.
And there's a tick.
Yes.
So now this one is going in a vial.
From there on out, it was pretty much ticks galore.
Another one.
Another one?
Yeah, we got two in one go. So, and there's a fourth.
Oh, no, you've got one there.
What, are you? Yeah, oh my gosh, they're probably on me.
By the end of the day, Zalkeld and Beck had nearly 100 ticks.
That's like a writhing ball
and
of ticks.
And that's a little, yeah, that's a little tick orgy.
Yep, that's what it looks like.
The tick orgy will eventually make its way to the lab bench of this scientist.
So I'm Alex Bias.
So you're officially the tick grinder and virus extractor.
That is my job today, yes.
On other days, Bias is a veterinarian. She's also working on a PhD studying West Nile virus. But today, it's ticks.
Here's some ticks.
Bias takes a Ziploc bag with vials of ticks out of the fridge. They look dead, but they aren't. Bias needs them alive to keep the potential viruses inside them fresh.
So they're all balled up because they're really cold. but once you take them out and bring them back up to room temperature, they'll get really active, which makes them sometimes kind of hard to pull out of the tubes. But
because they're like wiggling around?
They're crawling around. They crawl over each other. They like to grab onto the forceps. They can be surprisingly fast.
Bias will wrangle the reawakened ticks into little tubes with some liquid and a metal ball. Then she'll plop those into a machine that's somehow very appropriately called Retch.
They actually look kind of like coffee grounds.
Yeah, they do kind of look like coffee grounds, tick smithereens.
She'll take those smithereens and separate out the liquid, the part that might have viruses floating around inside, and then test for Colorado tick fever and Powassan virus. But she says you never know what else you might find.
Essentially, you're looking for things when you don't know exactly what's going to be in there, and that's how sometimes viruses that we don't even know about are discovered.
Bias and her colleagues should have answers by the end of the summer, but they'll keep collecting and checking in years to come, because things are always changing. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
In honor of Mother's Day, and with Father's Day right around the corner, children young and old will pause to thank their parents for the sacrifices they've made. Across the country, childcare is one of the biggest expenses families face. It can cost more to put an infant in daycare than it costs to send an 18-year-old to college. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson spoke with Linda Barton from the Wyoming After School Alliance about access to childcare in the state.
Linda, you work to advocate for access to after-school programming and summer learning for kids. And I know that that's about more than just childcare. But I'm wondering, what can you tell me about what you see working families in Wyoming facing when it comes to access to care for kids outside of school?
Summer, in particular, really poses some major challenges for our families who are working maybe even more than one job, and certainly if it's a two-parent family working two jobs and shift jobs, and it becomes very much an issue about what is going to happen during those summer months with their young children and even their older children.
Your work as an advocate has you connecting with folks from across the country. So from those exchanges that you have with people in other states, how does Wyoming compare when it comes to access to childcare and enriching programs?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. In terms of comparison, I think all states are struggling from lack of opportunities to have access to childcare facilities. I think in Wyoming, it probably is exacerbated because we live in small communities, so the centers are small or the childcare facilities, either a home-based program or a school-based program, just doesn't have the capacity. We don't have the human resources and the staff that can really open up and accept more children. So there are waiting lists in our smaller communities for slots for kids to be in either a home-based program or even one that is in a center somewhere, and they're very expensive. I've heard from folks that during the school year, they're spending maybe $400 or $500 a month, if they're lucky, per child, just on the after school care. If they're doing summer, I think the costs are probably prohibitive for so many families, even if there were a slot. So I do think we have an issue here about what to do with so many children that need to be in places while their parents are working.
You know, one thing I was thinking about is parents might just see that as an individual struggle. That's part of being a working parent. You got to figure out the logistics of summer camps and summer care. But I'm wondering, for you as an advocate, how do you approach this from a policy perspective?
Available money. And in Wyoming, there doesn't seem to be a stomach for providing more funding. For instance, state-funded even pre-K courses or state-funded programs available for kids. And without having access to those programs and not having the support, I think, of local communities financially, cities and counties, and on a state level to develop policies that would help support working families is, in my opinion, a tragedy that we are not taking that on more and making that available. It is the least we can do for our hardworking parents. That's my opinion. I know it sounds a little tough, but it is, in my opinion, something that should be number one priority for this state.
And there's been some good news on the funding front. The 2018 federal budget included increased funding for after-school and summer learning, as well as more funds for Head Start and subsidies that help low-income families pay for childcare.
Yes, we were very, very fortunate in getting increased funding for 2018. But 2019 is looming, and in the proposed federal budget for 2019, after-school and summer programs are still being zeroed out. That's the proposal. We still need to fight to retain those funds. In Wyoming, we have about 14,000 kids that are in after-school and summer learning programs, but there's another 35,000 out there waiting to be part of one. So we're still struggling in terms of increasing access and increasing the funding for creating more programs, and certainly creating, expanding the existing programs so that they can hire more staff, open it up to more kids, and do more things, and maybe expand their summer programs out a bit so that they're operating longer hours and more weeks in the summer. Those are challenging issues that we're all facing.
Linda Barton is the executive director of the Wyoming After School Alliance. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for letting me share some information with you.
Coming up on the program, we'll have a story about the importance of a new domestic violence protection effort on the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces. You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Earlier this spring, the two tribes on the Wind River Reservation adopted a new law to help them combat violence against women. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, for the first time, the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho will be able to prosecute crimes committed by non-natives.
It was on Thanksgiving night that Eastern Shoshone member Jean Harris's life took a terrifying turn. She'd been waiting for a text from her Northern Arapaho boyfriend asking her to come pick him up and bring him home. He'd been staying at his parents' for several weeks. She put on her clothes, reapplied her makeup, and drove to his parents' house on the reservation to get him. When she got there, he was waiting at the gate. But she says he didn't get in the car.
He said, "Babe, come give me a hug. I haven't seen you for a while. I'm going to grab my bag." So I said, "Okay." I got out of my car. I went over to give him a hug, and as he opened the gate, people came out from behind the trees and started coming towards me. And all I could hear them saying was, "Light her up, let's kill that white expletive. I'm a half-breed." Mm.
Harris is a small woman, but she fought back. She ran to her car for pepper spray and used it on her alleged assailants. Later, she learned that one was her boyfriend's new girlfriend. His brothers also joined the attack, but the spray didn't deter them.
They drug me inside of their property line. I curled up in a ball as to protect myself the best that I could and prayed that I would make it through it.
She later told police they kicked her and hit her with bricks. Afterwards, Harris called Bureau of Indian Affairs police. It took them an hour to arrive, and when they did, she felt they treated her like the criminal.
Perhaps the officers would have gotten some more training or at least some reading material or a briefing or something about domestic violence and how hard it is to report when the person that you love so much hurts you.
At the hospital, Harris found out she'd suffered a skull fracture. But the police made no arrests that night or since. In fact, she says she's been attacked twice since then and lives in fear that she will again. The county courts issued protection orders on some of her attackers, but she says her case isn't severe enough for the federal courts and that tribal courts don't currently have enough leverage to stop the violence. Harris's case is a familiar one to Eastern Shoshone Councilman Leslie Shakespeare, who used to be a BIA police officer.
Seeing that just on a nightly basis really got to me thinking, well, how do we break that cycle?
He even saw it in his own life with his sister. Her partner was non-native. Often, He saw her beaten and bruised.
I remember being fresh out of the academy, thinking I could change the world and arrest everybody's problems away. And I remember asking her, why don't you call the police? Why don't you do that? And she had stated, well, I did call before. And kind of gave me a smile and said, nothing's going to happen.
That was the last time Shakespeare saw his sister. She died under suspicious circumstances related to domestic violence, and her case never made it to court. Shakespeare says that's because tribes weren't legally allowed to prosecute non-natives. So last year, when Shakespeare became a councilman, he decided to act. And the timing was just right. The two tribes were just forming their own joint tribal court system. And in 2013, the Obama administration reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA. This update to the 1994 law now gave tribes the ability to vigorously prosecute such cases. Northern Arapaho Chairman Roy Brown says it hasn't been easy or cheap. It's involved arranging for many more prison beds and making sure all attorneys and judges were law trained. To tackle that one, they initiated a national employment search. Brown says it didn't take long before those job applications started rolling in. Every one of them were from Native women.
It was a welcome surprise, but at the same time, it wasn't surprising because Native women were the ones that are going to law school and focusing on issues like these.
Now, all the positions have been hired, and the Department of Justice is finalizing the paperwork so the tribal courts can start implementing the new domestic violence law. The Wind River Reservation is only the 18th of the 573 federally recognized tribes to adopt it.
And really, it's not being funded at the appropriate level from the federal government.
That's Caroline Laporte with the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. But she says, according to a new five-year report, VAWA 2013 has been very successful, with 143 arrests nationwide, most of them of non-natives, and 74 of those led to convictions.
One, non-natives are now hearing, okay, I no longer can get away with this. And two, Native women are hearing, okay, I can't be abused repeatedly without somebody coming to my assistance.
But Laporte says tribes still can't hold abusers accountable if they assault their child, only their partner. And they can't take cases where a victim was assaulted by a stranger, only if they were in a relationship.
That's a big loophole, and that's something that I think we're going to try to address this year.
As for Jean Harris, she has hope that the new, tougher law will be enforced in time to help her before her next attack.
I know it's a long process, but it makes me feel like I don't matter. And I have to tell myself all the time, I do matter. I do matter.
The Trump administration is due to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act sometime this year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Forest fire season is upon us, and over the next couple of weeks, we'll be introducing you to the people behind the scenes doing their jobs to keep us and our communities safe. We begin with a story about fires and fish. Yeah, that's actually an issue. Allie Budner talks to a biologist who crosses the fire line to protect aquatic species.
If you have legs or wings, you're probably going to run or fly away from a wildfire. Remember Bambi?
Get up, Bambi. You must get up.
But what if you're a fish?
We have, you know, equipment ready.
That's Josh Nearing.
If we need to jump on it and get into some place and rescue the fish.
Nearing's a second-generation aquatic biologist for Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Most of the time, his job involves surveying native fish populations and improving stream habitat. Except when wildfire threatens those rare species he works to protect. Then he springs into superhero action. That's what happened in the summer of 2016. Nearing got word from a fellow biologist that a nearby fire was picking up speed.
He gave me a call and said, we have this fire that's looking like it's going to burn up south prong of Hayden Creek, which we knew was an important cutthroat strain that we had in there.
He's talking about the greenback cutthroat trout. It's Colorado's state fish.
It's a beautiful fish, yeah. It has dark spots along its body. The name cutthroat comes from the orange slashes that they have right under their chin.
But this particular genetic variety of greenback cutthroat were only found living in this one stretch of this one creek, and they were in grave danger.
We had to move pretty fast.
Now, a quick side note here. You might be thinking, fish live in water. Why do they have to worry about wildfires? Well, it's not the fire that harms fish. It's the byproduct, ash.
The ash really changes the water quality. It'll change the pH of the water specifically. And trout in particular have a pretty narrow tolerance for pH changes.
And that's not the only thing to worry about. Fire is often followed by rain, and on burned ground, that can lead to floods.
And the sediment and, you know, muddy water that's coming down can just literally suffocate the fish.
These potential dangers were on Nearing's mind in 2016 as he made his way to Hayden Creek near Salida, Colorado. He knew he had to get some of the cutthroat trout out of the stream and into a hatchery, so if the rest perished, at least the genetic line would be saved. Still, most of the 30 or so scientists on Nearing's team had never been behind an active fire line.
It was a little nerve-wracking going in there and seeing smoke and smelling smoke.
They'd gotten safety training from the Forest Service, but still.
The helicopters were flying over and dropping water, and so it was a little bit scary that way.
Nearing takes me to a local stream and shows me the equipment they used.
Waders, and then dip nets and buckets and oxygen tanks. We take our backpack shockers into the creek.
Wait, a backpack shocker?
Yep, sort of looks like a Ghostbusters outfit.
With wands attached to the backpack. Those wands put a mild current in the water to attract and then stun the fish.
So we can dip net them out, get them in a bucket, and then get them to our stock tank and get them to our hatchery as fast as we can.
Now, 2 years after the 2016 fire, Nearing says the descendants of those cutthroat trout are thriving in a local hatchery and waiting to be put back in a healthy creek.
If we had not gone in there, we wouldn't have preserved those genes and they'd be gone forever.
And that kind of vigilance is an ongoing job. Nearing's got his eye on another rare strain of greenback cutthroat trout here at Bear Creek, just minutes from downtown Colorado Springs.
Oh, there's one right in the center of the stream, right there. See it right behind that log?
Oh, yeah.
If this area burns, Nearing says, he'll be ready to suit up and cross the fire line all over again. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
If you're looking for a new primary care doctor in states like Idaho or Wyoming, good luck. Our region has some of the worst doctor shortages in the country. But did you know there are physicians out there that could help, but can't practice? Amanda Peacher met with two refugee doctors from Iraq who are going through the arduous process to get an American doctor's license.
When Marwan Swaydan arrived as an Iraqi refugee in 2008, his first job in the U.S. was selling hot dogs at a baseball stadium.
It was fun. I know how to do hot dog now.
Swaydan was maybe a little overqualified for hot dog sales. Before fleeing Iraq, he worked as a trauma surgeon there. Swaydan now lives in Boise and works in the patient safety department at a hospital. But he wants to go back to being a doctor.
So here's the thing. Being a doctor in the United States coming as a refugee is a little bit challenging because we are not prepared for the system.
That system requires passing three huge medical exams and then applying for a multi-year medical residency program. Even if they did get that far, very few refugees are offered residency positions in Idaho.
The program directors look at us as a lost cause kind of thing.
Swaydan says there are a lot of reasons for that.
They don't have three letters of recommendations from United States. They never practice in the United States. And probably their English is kind of challenging. So there's no way for you to say, well, I'm going to neglect the Harvard graduate and take this guy.
But those guys have lots of training. For example, Iraq follows British medical training protocols, so doctors like Swaydan have years of legitimate schooling.
And the only way to practice medicine now in the United States is to start all over.
That's Dr. Scott Smith with the Veterans Administration in Boise.
Surprisingly, some of them want to do all that.
Smith acts as a guide and mentor for refugee doctors who want to get their license. He helps with things like cover letters and interview preparation. He's on a mission.
So these are people that we need to serve the communities because it is so hard to get a physician in our state.
But it's a long, expensive process to become qualified. Just ask Ali Mackey. He fled Iraq with his family back in 2006. Like many Iraqi doctors, Mackey says he received threats from insurgents when he treated Iraqi law enforcement.
So it was really dangerous to work as a doctor over there.
When he got to the U.S., there was no question for Mackey that he'd try to be a doctor. And he was lucky enough to get one of the rare residencies in Idaho. But it took him 8 years of work and study to get that position. And that's on top of his training in Iraq.
Yeah, there are certain points that were really frustrating. They were really hard. And why am I doing this? Like, I've already graduated. And why can't I just practice right away? But it just, you have to respect the system.
For Mackey, all that work was worth it.
This is what I made to do, and I love doing it.
Mackey plans on staying right here in Idaho once he's licensed as a physician. But that happy ending is a long way off for Marwan Swaydan. He's still studying for his U.S. medical exams. After 8 hours of his hospital job and 2 hours of a physiology class, Swaydan is logging into his study program. Today's session starts with a video.
This chapter deals with kidney and urinary tract pathology. We're going to begin with congenital lesions.
So this isn't something you can just kind of do on your lunch break. You really have to have a set.
No, you have to dedicate minimum of 5 hours. When I say 5 hours, it's five, exact hours minimum. Yeah, every day.
Swaydan's office is sparse and mostly filled with study books. But one thing stands out. It's a photo pinned above his desk. It's of an anonymous child picking food off the street.
It's a little boy. As you can see, he's very emaciated and thin. He's eating remnants of bread from the ground that he found. And it's just remind me of my mission.
That mission? To serve people like the boy in the picture. People who need help and who need care. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Peacher in Boise.
When we come back, we'll hear about a roadkill study and a story about a major fossil find. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Mountain West states like Wyoming and Montana are high risk for wildlife vehicle collisions. These accidents result in expensive damages and sometimes even death for both wildlife and drivers. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports that one group of scientists found an unlikely solution.
Out here on Sinks Canyon Road in southwestern Wyoming, there's barely any traffic this morning. But this highway is one of the state's hotspots for wildlife vehicle collisions. The canyon is a corridor to the Wind River mountain range for animals, and the road winds up steep hills and tight corners. There aren't any deer or other big game on the drive to meet conservation scientist Corinna Reginos, but she says that may have been because of the time of day.
Dusk and dawn, particularly dusk, I think is when the most collisions occur. Deer tend to be active at that time, and you also tend to have more cars on the road. So if you think about the dead middle of the night, you have a lot of deer activity, but not that many cars.
You've probably driven by one before and not noticed it, but wildlife reflectors are poles on the side of the road,
which are intended to flash when headlights hit them and warn deer that a car is coming and make the deer stop and be more cautious about crossing the road.
And there have been a lot of studies on reflectors, but Regino says
the results are really mixed and not very impressive.
So the Wyoming Department of Transportation asked Reginos to lead a group of scientists and figure out whether or not the reflectors were actually keeping animals off the road. So Reginos and her team developed an experiment. They cover up some reflectors, leave others uncovered, and then compare the results.
So we covered them with this cheap and easily available and durable material, which just happened to be white canvas bags.
And to their surprise, the bags turned out to be more effective than the reflectors. Regino says they used thermal video footage to look at how the deer were behaving.
And we could actually see that in the white bags situation, the deer were more likely to stop and wait for cars to pass before crossing the road rather than just like running headlong into the road.
They also looked at the total number of deer hit by cars under the two different conditions, and the white bags prevailed. Regino says the reflection of headlights on the bags might have simply startled the deer and alerted them to the cars.
It's also possible that that looked to them like their rump patch. A lot of times deer, you know, raise their tail and they show a white rump as a warning sign of a predator or other danger.
Finding solutions like this are important. Drivers in Wyoming have a 1 in 79 chance of hitting wildlife. John Oman with State Farm Insurance says hitting a deer with your car is one problem.
But sometimes we end up seeing a bigger safety issue by folks being almost prideful about not hitting that deer, that elk, or that moose. And then, of course, they go off the road or they, you know, roll their vehicle or, you know, hit into an icy patch or something.
Oman says not only are these accidents dangerous, they're expensive, too.
The average deer hit, the average elk hit, if you will, the average moose hit, we're, as in State Farm, is roughly paying out an average of $5,325 per claim.
According to the Wyoming Department of Transportation, there's about 6,000 big game vehicle collisions every year. Oman says that high number could be because of the large volume of wildlife, especially deer. Wyoming also has a higher speed limit than a lot of states. The same is true for Montana, where drivers have a 1 in 57 chance of hitting wildlife. Both states have incorporated what Corinna Reginos says is the best prevention tool.
The gold standard is underpasses or overpasses or both, with plenty of fencing on either side so that the animals have to go and cross the road at those under and overpasses. And those are 80 to 90% effective consistently throughout the world.
But crossing structures aren't always possible, especially in places like Sinks Canyon, where the landscape isn't very practical. They're also very expensive.
And that's when, you know, continuing to explore other options like the white bag effect are, I think, necessary.
But Regino says the solution probably isn't to go put a bunch of white canvas bags along Wyoming's highways.
I would love to find some partners to take it forward and develop like a true technology that does better than the white canvas bags and test it thoroughly and see if we can come up with something lasting and effective.
For now, Reginos has some advice for drivers. Slow down where wildlife may be crossing and keep your eyes on the road. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
A fossil uncovered in 2016 could help shed light on the evolution of rhinos and tapir, a kind of tall, furry pig with a long snout. The 50-million-year-old mammal was found on a state-leased quarry in southwest Wyoming's Green River Formation. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports the fossil is now being prepared for research.
On a bright, cloudless day in southwest Wyoming, Rick Hebden drives over a steep dirt road, one of his quarries. He's a commercial fossil collector.
Well, like I told you what my dad said, it's like digging in the Cracker Jacks looking for the prize.
Hebden steps onto the crater-like formation and points to small black fish imprints on the ground. He explains the Green River Formation used to be covered in lakes. 50 million years ago, Wyoming had a climate like Florida, so he's used to uncovering fish fossils.
99 out of 100 times you're going to find a fish. And then sometimes you get an insect or a leaf, something that gives you a little surprise, you know? But to find the mammals, that's why I said it's crazy rare to even have them out here.
Finding a mammal is so rare because 50 million years ago, mammals were just taking off. They're evolving to become the modern animals we know today. So when Hebden found one, he was excited.
Up in this layer, right there. And that's where this new mammal was found. And it was right here.
He saw well-preserved hooves, a long femur, a tooth, and a mostly put-together rear half. Hebden reached out to a paleontologist who couldn't find a match for the species. But he did find out it might be the largest mammal ever found in the Green River Formation. Hebden's quarry was state-leased, so soon after he found the fossil, it went to the Wyoming State Geological Survey. A paleontologist in North Carolina narrowed down what it could be, finding it was likely a tapir morph, the group that gave rise to modern rhinos and tapirs. Director of University of Wyoming's Geologic Museum, Mark Clements, says that's exciting. This fossil could help answer long-held questions about where tapiomorphs came from.
Which continent was their home is a big question, and there's a lot of debate surrounding it because their fossils are kind of found all over those different continents. And maybe it's a North American origin for either tapirs, rhinos, or tapirs and rhinos based on this fossil.
An advisory board organized a search for a preparator, someone who frees a fossil from the rock. Many, like Hebden, have been anxious for the preparation, to find out just what animal it is. And now that person has been chosen.
My name is Mike Eklund.
Eklund is a specialist located in Illinois. He's just begun preparing the specimen.
The piece that I'm working on today has, according to the x-ray, a very nice articulated leg with all of the foot bones and everything.
He says the bones look almost black and are encased in tan-colored rock. He uses small needles, mini air jackhammers, and hand tools to remove the bone. But he's also been setting up technology to see what the naked eye cannot.
I've been working on using fluorescence illumination and getting images of the specimen before work has begun. But also, I spent a fair bit today getting the time-lapse photography set up.
Time-lapse photography, special lighting, extra magnification, those are all special skills Wyoming Small Advisory Board wanted in a preparator, because it can help Eklund find biological information that might otherwise be lost.
There's a lot more tissues and other things present that get missed very often that we just need to look closer for and have a chance of finding them.
Soft tissue. That's the name of the game here. It's pretty rare, but Eklund and the Geological Survey expect to find it given how well the fossil's been preserved. Soft tissue can shed light on how the animal looked, size of its snout, shape of its ears, or what its diet was. It's not guaranteed to find all that information, of course, but it could
put a better picture together of the environment it was from, as well as the actual biologic details of this mammal.
Eklund is still around 2 months away from fully removing the fossil from its rock surroundings. Once it's prepared, the specimen will be housed within the Wyoming State Geological Survey in Laramie, with the chance to be on loan for display or research elsewhere. Back at the quarry in the Green River Formation, Rick Hebden stands by the site where this special fossil was originally found. He's uncovered crocodiles, bats, and palm leaves in his lifetime of fossil hunting. But he says this is something brand new, and that's exciting, both for him and for science. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear an individual segment or the entire program again, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces.
You can also find past programs on that website and daily news items. Anna Rader is our web editor. We also invite you to become a fan of our Facebook page, and all of our reporters are on Twitter.
I'd also like to remind you that we always appreciate good story ideas and interview suggestions for the show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.